You want to kick us off, Jim?
Yeah, good morning, everybody. This is our season two of our smartfuture.org podcast with Dr. Marv Langston and myself, Jim Petrosini. Today, we have the honor of Dave McDonald out in Hawaii. And Dave, would like to do a little introduction of yourself, please?
Sure. Greetings and top of the morning. It's just getting my day started here in Hawaii, in Hawaii Standard Time. So likewise, it's an honor to be on the call with you, Marv, and Jim. I've been a follower of both of you for some years. Marv, in particular, you may not remember many, many years ago when I was quite junior, you came and visited Denver, and I was part of the briefing team. So I've followed your career for a long time. So it is an honor to be on. Just by way of brief introduction, so I work for the Department of the Navy, actually speaking on behalf of the Department of the Navy in this session. That's important. This is kind of just a sideline open conversation. I'm the CIO and the Plans and Programs Director for the Navy Computer and Telecommunications Area Master Station based out here in the Hawaiian Islands. Among other things, I kind of look out over the Naval Network Enterprise Pacific and think about current and future capabilities, resilience and hardening of the command and control services and systems and missions that we perform. We reach all the way well into the Indian Ocean, actually all the way to the East Coast and throughout the Indo-Pacific region with critical command and control services, whether it's MilSatCom, commercial SATCOM, IP networks, RF communications, base communications, you know, all that legacy fiber and copper that runs in the ground around our bases and stations. So that's what I do for a living. I've been at NICTAMS for coming up on about 16 years. I'm a career cryptologist, if anybody still uses that term now, information warfare qualified officer. I did 34 years in uniform, 17 active and 17 reserve, retired from uniform service in 2016. So that's kind of just a brief summary of who I am and what I do now.
Thanks, Dave. So I guess just to kind of maybe start the discussion, what do you see as kind of the top, say, two or three projects, technologies, just things going on out there that you think are going to make a huge impact on our defense world, you know, the threat and all that?
Yeah, so Jim, I guess, you know, there's a couple ways to kind of attack the question. One would be to sort of compartmentalize, you know, individual research areas or technology areas. And I can talk to some of that, but writ large, I think on the technology and the research and development and the systems design front, I think where the breakthroughs are going to be achieved, it will be in, I'll call it synthesis or horizontal integration and an aggregation of game-changing technologies across a lot of fronts into compelling, game-changing, kind of asymmetric advantage architecture designs. So there's a lot to unpack there. Let me get at it a little bit. You know, if you take automation, unmanned, kind of Internet of military things, Internet of space things, if you take that idea to its logical extent at scale, and then you consider all the things that have to get integrated into that in terms of the form factors for power, the form factors for compute, the design of that architecture in a manageable mesh kind of networked, synchronizable architecture, and then the logic, you know, the software systems that it will take to manage, synchronize, sense, maneuver, deceive, field and surge and reconstitute, that is an aggregate sort of architecture that's wickedly hard to think about. You know, some might put that in the context of JADC2, right? The all domain command and control kind of model. So you can envision what that would look like. Within that kind of designed holistic architecture, you can drill into key technology areas, robotics, automation, autonomous, you know, kind of machine learning driven maneuver and that sort of technology area. You can drill all the way down to bare metal and consider, you know, the compute and computer science kind of foundational capabilities that we have to kind of leapfrog our way out of current technology and think about the future. And this is short of quantum computing. This is you know, just how we consider computer science, how we think about things like getting away from binary and Boolean sort of computer science and moving to more of a multi-level sort of compute architecture. I'm very interested in the research into batteries, right? Over and above lithium batteries, but high density, low size, weight, and heat type of battery research. I think that's going to be very critical to this Internet of Military Things, Internet of Space Things. And then from a security perspective, people talk broadly with big hand waves about zero trust, but when you drill into zero trust, you find a whole range of really key enabling technologies, whether it's advanced new ways of thinking about encryption of data at rest, encryption of data in transaction between an Internet of Things mesh, the control plane, management plane kind of architectures that allow us to maneuver, sense, and monitor and be situational aware of our security architectures, technologies on the authentication front and access management front, all sort of coming together in a zero trust operations kind of environment that allows you to sort of maneuver that kind of architecture at scale. So there's a lot of technologies embedded in that conversation, I think, that are really important. I think we'll probably also want to talk about space, right? The renaissance in commercial space as it might apply to this conversation of, you know, Internet of Military Things, Internet of Space and Ground Military Things.
So you're on the, you know, you just maybe from the operational side out in Hawaii, what do you see as far as, you know, we hear this, let's go faster, innovation, DevSecOps. Is the ops part really, is the fleet really getting involved in the development and, you know, the true real time process, as opposed to we take 10 years or 15 years to build something and then the fleet doesn't see it
right
until, you know, till after it's already built. So maybe you can elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, Jim, that's a fascinating area to get into. You know, it has its foundations in the structure of governance that we have grown and matured over so many decades, that everybody's gotten very used to and very, I guess, very tolerant of or comfortable with, you know, as the case might be. Along came technology and just leapfrog right over the top of us, right, in terms of the DoD and intelligence community acquisition systems and so forth. And we're all left kind of scratching our heads and asking, how do we find that balance between robust research and development investment, developing asymmetric advantage technologies, doing it fast, proving it fast, and then sort of hitting the valley of death or hitting the dead end and saying, well, okay, how do we drive this towards scale, and how do we think through and plan for the life cycle support of fielding operations, maneuver, and defense at scale, right? So those are governance problems, among other things. They're process problems. They're in some ways, they're technology problems in and of themselves, but they're really governance problems at the core. And I think, you know, there's a group out there that calls for whole scale defense acquisition reform. You know, just toss out the whole thing and replace it with something else. I've not ever really been in that camp. I think, there have been so many well funded acquisition reform, acquisition improvement studies over the last decade that really have some pointed recommendations that we have to dig into. To seek out this sweet spot between a speed to delivery, speed to market, speed to warfighter, getting out of the habit of allowing the valley of death to sort of dead end our most compelling research and development successes, and figuring out how to drive that wicked problem of speed to scale, you know, speed to full architecture scale, and then have a programmatic and sort of acquisition and the financing system that anticipates and accommodates and reacts to fielding at scale. So I live in the operations and maintenance world, right? I'm not an acquisition guy. We're not an acquisition organization. You know, we have things kind of thrown over the fence at us, and then we have to integrate them and operate them and maintain them. So I live in that tyranny of life cycle O&M, right? Operations and maintenance programs being sort of systemically short-sheeted or underfunded because of a lack of anticipation of what a thing is going to look like at scale. So this is a very important topic to me, Jim. Governance to get to how do we rationalize a DevSecOps rapid, spiral user-centered delivery sort of approach within a system of record? And then how do we make sure that, you know, training, operations, maintenance, life cycle, all that stuff on the back end is there, as this thing fields and scales and goes to war?
Over. Let me pull the thread a little bit on that with you, Dave. I've been saying for a while, and most people are too young to understand this, we basically over-politicized the acquisition system after Goldwater Nichols in 1986, because prior to that, we did the acquisition systems on the CNO side of the fence with the secretariat overlooking it, overseeing it, but they didn't make all the decisions. They didn't have the milestone decision authority that created the 100 briefs to every decision that we have sitting in the Pentagon today. But we do have the congressionally approved ability to use other transaction authorities, OTAs. And I'm a really big fan of prototype to production. And I'm actually a big fan of moving more acquisition authority to the operational commanders, like we've done with Transcom and SpecOps. So I'm curious what your thought would be if we did try to do more prototype to production using tools like DevSecOps, using all of these modern acquisition innovations that you referred to, and getting away from locking ourselves up in a world that, in my opinion, keeps causing the Navy to run backwards while other navies are running forward. I think it's a recipe for disaster, it appears.
Yeah. So Marv, I've seen and read recommendations to that effect before. Pushing more of that acquisition fielding kind of programmatic and procurement and warrant authority out to operational commanders. And, you know, I guess I'm a little mixed on that. I think that could potentially be as disappointing as what we currently have, because there's so many nuances in the execution of that. I'll get to a couple points about that. One is, I've been on a component staff. I was a junior officer many years ago on the PAC fleet staff. I was a civilian division chief on the Indo-PACOM headquarters staff some years ago before I came up here to NICTAM. So I kind of lived in that ecosystem of, warfighting headquarters staffs, four-star staffs, and so forth. They have enough trouble focusing on the main thing, right, in many ways. The main thing is warfighting readiness. The main thing is a rapid, agile, sort of response to the day's events. Fight tonight, fight tomorrow, fight next week. They have enough to worry about in being an effective either combatant command or component command, being an effective driver of requirements up to the acquisition system, up through the R&D system. So I'm not sure the solution is to sort of bolt on, acquisition and fielding sort of thing on warfighting headquarters steps. Having said that, I think there's if one is considering, some acquisition reform approaches that start to solve this bifurcation between research and development, acquisition and fielding, life cycle support, operations and maintenance, the associated infrastructure, and so forth. It's my theory that we live within sort of the tyranny of colors of money. If you think about this, we organize around colors of money. We define our governance around colors of money. We define our processes within governance around colors of money. And then everybody gets acculturated to executing to colors of money. And each of those colors of money, whether it's RDT&E, procurement, MilCon, manpower, right, MPN, operations and maintenance, you know, this all kind of cascades out of, you know, the imperative for proper congressional oversight and the structure of colors of money. What it prevents us from doing, if I could connect the dot, right? So, right, great book, right? Kill Chain. And Christian Broz, who's sort of the new Mahanian for the 21st century, says that we're not architecting, investing, acquiring, fielding to kill chain. We're doing it based on platforms. We're doing it based on these kind of isolated things that really derive from color of money, and then trying to, in any way, trying to synchronize, you know, the efforts of RDT&E, you know, acquisition, fielding, life cycle support, and all the underpinning infrastructure, manpower, you know, both civilian, military, contractor manpower, and so forth. You know, I mean, we hardly have a fighting chance, right? Because we're just programmatically not designed right to build and field and operate to the kill chain idea, which it's a whole different idea, right? So I think there's some real room for innovation, study, research, getting the smartest people in a room to sort of talk about this and figure out how to engage Congress and say, hey, we just hobbled ourselves with our structures here, right? Does that make sense, Mark?
Yeah, but let me just add a little bit to it, because I've spent the last 15 years out here with the Spay War, now Nav War world. And what I fail to see in almost every place is a concern about speed to capability. You know, they're all concerned about the Pentagon and their budgets and their next meeting, and meetings are designed to plan the next meeting. But nobody lives day to day with the feeling that they've got to get capability out fast. So I've suggested for years also what we could be doing is making the number one metric for acquisition speed to capability that could be applied and measured down through every part of the organization, contracts, program offices, legal offices. Everybody could get measured on speed and capability. And below speed of capability, you could tear down the cost, performance, and schedule or whatever. But back in the day where I grew up in the Aegis world, Wayne Meyer never missed cost, performance, and schedule. And today I can't find any programs that ever make cost, performance, or schedule, right? So we've clearly gotten off track in a way that doesn't make a lot of sense for us. And we have to figure out a way to turn it around. And to that end, to your point about the fleet, I in our world, in the IT world, I'm always reminded that the only reason we have JOTS is because Jerry Tuttle diverted operational money and created JOTS, and Archie Clemens diverted operational money and created IT21, right? So the two biggest innovations in our world came from charismatic fleet operators who said, screw colors of money, we're going to make this work. And the other thing I like about OTAs is they're colors of money agnostic. You can apply any color you want. Now, the contractors and legal officers don't like it, but they don't really have a say if they listen to the law.
Yeah, and I'll update some of your references to charismatic, you know, charismatic leadership or charismatic influence. You know, look at what our Navy CIO Aaron Weiss has done in and through the pandemic, and now, you know, somewhat quote unquote post pandemic. Some don't believe we're there yet, but you look at what Aaron Weiss has done with the, you know, speed to warfighter of flank speed, and you know, some of the direction that has occurred from both Aaron Weiss and from CNO Gilday on overmatch, and you know, the, you know, kind of turning the ship on a vector that most people have found fairly bracing and surprising, right? So but having said that, right, I think even if Mr. Weiss were here in the conversation, he'd say, you know, an acquisition construct, an acquisition, you know, sort of regime across the DoD that has to rely on, you know, highly charismatic senior leaders who have the authority and the swing weight, you know, to re-vector the ship that quickly. You know, that's not a good model, right? I don't think, you know, that doesn't scale well, and it's not predictable. Really hard to rely on. So more structural, foundational things are really worthy of consideration. If our whole speed to warfighter, you know, getting out of the valley of death and so forth, just relies on, you know, charismatic leaders who are able to break the rules without getting fired, we're sort of in trouble, right? So I'd want to do a lot more than that. You know, Valley of Death is one of my favorite subjects. I think structurally, if we wanted to go after one very high priority area in that chasm, that systemic sort of, you know, predictable chasm we have between, you know, successful R&D investment and outcomes and transition to scale and program of record discipline, you know, I think the DoD writ large could go after that in some very precise ways. It would also involve a conversation with Congress and probably some organizational construct changes that you talk about, you know, metrics and measurement and accountability for speed to market or speed to warfighter. To be more precise about that, I'd want to have metrics and measurement for how often do R&D investments dead end, and put some accountability and some measurement into that, and really be disciplined about trying to solve that at significant scales. Hard problem, very hard problem, been studied a lot. But I think if we got at that, a lot of other things would start to kind of take care of themselves, or you'd see a lot more successes in having your most valuable RDT in the investments make it to scale. And as I've said in many contexts, scale is its own innovation problem in and of itself. It's a fiscal innovation problem. It's a project and program execution innovation problem. It's a lifecycle management innovation problem, right? So you know, getting at Valley of Death is.
Let me add a couple of thoughts on that, because it's one of my favorite subjects, and then we'll come back in here. But I've thought a lot about that situation, and what you said earlier is right. And Wayne Meyer always said this: we get how we're organized, right? So you can see on a ship the organization of the acquisition department. And because we have Office of Navy Research spending all the 6263 money to the tune of almost $3 billion a year, they have no significant tie to pushing it over the transom and getting it to support the other side, nor does the other side have any real reason or drive to make that S&T get picked up and fielded, with some exceptions, right? But one way we could do it is treat the organizations more like startup companies. And when you start a project in S&T that looks like it's successful, you carry that project all the way through to delivery, just like a startup organization does. And that way you could integrate the delta between O&R and systems commands in a much different way, and let the people be much more fluid in how they sit in those organizations, instead of locking them into a shop where they wait around until they retire, right? And worry about how fast that's going to come, as opposed to the delivery of capability. But all great subjects. Probably not going to.
Yeah,
I was going to sort of drop anchor on that a little bit with a very current and very salient example that, you know, we can crystal ball a little bit over the next 2, 3, 4 years, right? Two plus years ago, OSD R&E, you know, collaborating with Congress, earmarked, I don't have the exact numbers, but I think it was somewhere just in excess of $1 billion in RDT&E funds for 5G next G, right? So we've instantiated these tranche one and tranche two 5G experimental pilots, you know, across the DoD at our bases and stations, you know, smart base, fixed wireless access, you know, some tactical type of applications, right? If you look at the use cases within each of those projects, they're all different. They're all really, really fascinating. And the foundational technology is 5G next G. You know, so that's RDT&E money. Those are OSD R&E sponsored programs and projects. The MILDEPs, right? The components are out there executing through OTAs, IWRP, and National Spectrum Consortium, and so forth. You know, so here's a test, right? Here's a test over the next 3 to 5 years, right? I'm very confident that some or many of those 5G experiments are going to demonstrate total executability, the ability to secure, maneuver, build diversity and resilience in form factors that are affordable and sustainable, right? You know, so at a certain point, we've got to make that risk decision and say, what does 5G at significant scale look like? And who's going to do it, right? So it's fascinating that today we have OSD R&E and DoD CIO and, you know, USD ANS needing to have these cross-functional working teams, you know, to go clear the whiteboard and talk about, you know, what does 5G next G look like at scale, and how would we do it? How would we execute it? Right. That's a multi-organizational sort of thing that we have to have, you know, fill a room with 40 or 50, you know, big thinkers and impose all kinds of policy and governance, you know, considerations on the thing. You know, so my question is, why is it that hard, right? If you had AT&T or Verizon or Comcast or name your MNO or your telco, if you had them in the room, they'd say, why are you guys making this so hard? This is not that hard, right? Even whether it's standalone or non-standalone or, you know, treated as a weapon system or a commodity, it's not that hard. You know, so this is indicative. It's a very current use case of how broken we are, right? And it'll be an interesting test to see over the next few years. Can the DoD do 5G next G at scale, right?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to add, I had a kind of an interesting conversation with the Slack rep yesterday. And, you know, I on a positive, you know, we rolled out flank speed in the Navy, but there's 12,000 Slack users in the Navy, of which 9,000 are Nav Air. And, yeah. You know, in kind of this scenario, like back kind of the JOTS example, you know, when we do define a requirements document, say it on a program at Nav War, why don't we have a fleet guy sitting out at Paycom review the document in real time on Office 365, right? So you don't need to wait a month or 3 months. And, you know, if you really want to do the ops and DevSecOps, who are the ops guys that are part of that program? And it's not, you know, it's not a contractor who does testing the way we do it in the old days. It's an ops guy that looks at the app in real time and says, that makes sense or it doesn't make sense, right? And right. We could all either be on a Teams channel together or a Slack channel together. And we, you know, but that, I think the point being that's cultural, because a lot of people just don't understand how to do asynchronous communications. Or when you say the word DevSecOps, they have no idea what you're talking about. Right. So
yeah,
we're doing these podcasts. A lot of this is just to educate our community. But as you know, what you see in the commercial world, you can go a lot faster, you know, with asynchronous communications, and our processes slow that down, right? Or it's not politically correct to say, well, let's get Dave McDonald to review this requirements document in real time, and you got a day to look at it, right?
Right. Well, Jim. So, Jim, fantastic subject. You know, as an aside, I'd like to see some enterprising, mid-grade officer at DAU or Naval Postgraduate School or somewhere, you know, do a whole paper on how to put the ops in DevSecOps, right? What does that mean? How to really unpack that? So it's this is really a 5-meter target for us out here right now, and in a good way. I'll express a little bit some of my I'm encouraged by one of the key program offices that it's very, very central to delivering capability for our fleet command and control capabilities throughout Indo-Pac and really throughout the world, and they are rapidly maturing their way into a software forge, software factory, DevSecOps, rapid delivery, spiral delivery kind of model. You know, I was kind of thinking about DevSecOps before DevSecOps was cool, going back 20 years ago, working with NavWar, Syscom, SpaceWar at the time, on what they used to call user-centered design. Remember user-centered design?
Yep.
Right. So this particular program office out of PEO C4I in space, just in the last 18 months or so, decided, you know, we're going the DevSecOps way. And to their great credit, one of the first things they figured out was, who is our user audience out there across the fleet and ops? You know, Navy's got 4 fleet and ops. We're one of them. And it's not just, you know, having, you know, CIO at a NICTAMS review or requirements paper. It's weekly deep engagement in online collaboration tools to be involved in every spiral delivery in that DevSecOps model. It's aggressive engagement with our policy authorities for, you know, the RMF process, A&A, to sort of figure out how to spiral that and have that keep pace with DevSecOps deliveries. It's the gateway governance and acceptance processes. It's, you know, operational verification and test. How do we do that iteratively based on incremental fast deliveries? You know, so there's, and so I'm encouraged and enthusiastic about this, but I'm also kind of sober about it, right? This is hard work. It puts a whole new set of imperatives on a program office to do that ops piece, that ops collaboration piece of DevSecOps. The programs that are willing to do it and understand how to use that to change the culture, they're going to succeed. And again, I'm encouraged by this particular program office out of San Diego. That's I think they're figuring it out. And we're figuring it out too, because it's work for us. Now I got to figure out, do we have the right SMEs in the room? Are they engaged? Do they even understand, you know, the S&T process, the acquisition process, the fielding process? You know, do they understand the technology they're looking at? Do they understand the language of systems engineers and DevSecOps code guys, you know, who are sort of spiraling these capabilities? Are they culturally disposed toward that rapidity and level of change in the baseline? You guys know a lot of operators out in the field are kind of just leave me alone. I learned my thing. I've been doing my thing for 5 years. And, you know, that now you've got, you know, some new widget or new tool that you're going to drop into the baseline with all these expectations. And, you know, it's that there's creative tension, right, that happens.
In yeah, the ops it's cultural change. It's cultural, right? It's okay. I mean, right now you can commit a build and you run the scan automatically, right? So this idea that we're going to give the build to somebody to do a scan and wait 8 months for an RMF document, that kind of goes away, right? You did the scan an hour after you committed the build, right? And that's completely different. So I think a lot of this is education and truly leadership going, we're going to change the way we do things, right?
And risk management, right? There has to be a level of understanding of and management of risk, and also knowing when you've crossed a threshold with regard to risk, right? Because, you know, if DevSecOps is kind of routinely breaking you in some way, well, you're not doing it right, right?
Well, it is encouraging to hear that that program office is working with you guys interactively to put the ops in DevSecOps, because very few program offices out here understand what ops means. And ONR has been doing it for the stuff that Wayne Paris and now some of those guys that are doing the undersea stuff with Second Fleet, with Third Fleet is doing a good job of that. But most of the program offices are only touching the operational guys once every 6 months or 12 months with some capability to say, hey, what do you think about this? And maybe do a little bit of ops, but it does need to be integrated in a way that doesn't kill the operational side of you guys, but also gives you the opportunity to shape it while it's being developed so that we could quit worrying so much about writing requirements and worry a lot more about building capability that we need.
Yeah, so Marv, there's you just sparked a thought. You know, there's I'll use the phrase, there's good, bad, and ugly, you know, associated with this. And you know, some of the ugly is this. It's even though you might be in a very creative, very robust, and very good close interaction with a program office, and in the particular case I mentioned, it's weekly. Okay, we're having really good, deep weekly interactions with the engineers. So it's fascinating, it's challenging, it's good. I am mindful sort of at a slightly higher level that you know, we're doing all of that, what I call left of POM, right? You know, so you're in execution year, right? And this is the tyranny of, you know, congressional oversight. It's the tyranny of the POM process, right? So depending on the threshold of a delivery, you know, in that rapid spiral delivery model, right? You have to be mindful that if something can get done to your baseline that really has resource implications on the O&M and life cycle side. And you know, while you're talking about it, you've missed the train, right? Because we just did POM 25, right? Our input up to our type command and up through the resource sponsor. We just put pencils down on POM 25. We're in a weekly scrum with, you know, program office X about deliveries through the remainder of 22 into 23 and 24. You know, so just ponder that, right? So everything that we might come up with that is a resource implication in lifecycle and O&M is an unfunded, you know, sort of weird kabuki dance that I've got to have with our higher headquarters to make sure that we're not the, you know, weakest link in the chain, right? So all of this happens left of POM is really the point, Mark.
I love that phrase, left of POM. I hadn't heard it before, but we are running about past 35 minutes almost. But
I will say that DevSecOps world has a buzzword called shifting left. right? So
maybe
shifting left is key to the POM thing, right? Because
that whole process. Right. If resource sponsor shifts left with them, you know, and can manage to negotiate that with Congress, then we're going to get somewhere. It's the more the PMW or the PEO shifts left, the potentially more challenging, you know, the life cycle implications can be.
Right? But I also will throw out, you know, these new shape companies, like we mentioned, Palmer Luckey's attitude is, hey, government, you don't need to pay me to build anything. I'm going to build it first and then you can buy it. Right. And he's got $1 billion that he can spend. But, you know, if you look at Palantir and, you know, maybe that's the future, is we've got enough wealthy people like Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and Palmer Luckey that they can, you know, they can invest in the defense world. And that's the shape culture that's rocking the defense industry, right? Because we don't need money from you. Right. We're just going to build it and people are going to use Starlink because it works. Right. Things like that.
Yeah, and you know, big industry out there. I'll say they sort of have the luxury or the option, you know, the course of action to seek to own entire, you know, verticals, right? Whereas the DoD, because of the tyranny, and this conversation points back to sort of what I said a half an hour ago about the tyranny of colors of money and the tyranny of the sort of congressional oversight that governs colors of money. Right, this whole DevSecOps and putting the ops in DevSecOps is entirely illustrative of that. It's entirely illustrative of that. And also the conversation about the sweet spot or balance between governance, you know, disciplined governance and programmatic and fiscal governance and speed to warfighter, right? Nobody said these problems were easy. This is sort of world hunger that we're trying to solve here. The putting the ops in DevSecOps is very much part of that. We're living it right now, and it ain't perfect, right? It's very difficult, and I'm not quite sure how the movie ends, right?
Well, as an endpoint, let me just say again, Archie Clemens, IT21, and Jerry Tuttle's JOTS were left of Palm, and they became programs of record. So maybe that is one way we can go. It feeds back to what I keep talking about. We need to prototype to production. We have the authorities to do it now more than ever. We just have to have charismatic leaders to do that. And by the way, that's part of my PhD dissertation about how bureaucracies work. Max Weber, who's the father of the word bureaucracy, said from the beginning, it's important to have bureaucracies to run big organizations and big things, but you can't make them do anything more than have meetings, basically, unless a charismatic leader rises up and pushes through the system and everybody that is a naysayer says, wow, that guy's good, I'm going to follow him, and they say yes.
Marvel, I agree with that, by the way. I didn't mean a few minutes ago to sort of dismiss or denigrate the notion of those really charismatic leaders who are not afraid to lead, right? They're, you know, but part of our culture and our bureaucracy is, you know, you got to ascend to a certain level and have a certain level of top cover and protection to be able to do that. You know, charisma or not, yeah. You better be protected. I've seen some really charismatic people flame out and get, you know, shown the back door because they were change makers and they spoke truth and power and so forth. Right. So there's a real challenge with this as well, culturally.
In the world. We're looking for our next Rickover, right? That's the sequel to this podcast.
Well, I will, but I can remind us that Rickover started from the captain level and rose to the top. Myers started from the captain level, rose to the top. Rod Rempt started from the captain level and put BMD on our ships out there in the Pacific.
So I mentioned a charismatic leader who's current, right? So I've gently encouraged Mr. Aaron Weiss to stick around for at least another decade. He's a change maker and a charismatic leader I really admire. Is he delivering results? The problem is the staying power of some of these folks is not what it needs to be to really make enduring strategic change, right? So that's one I'd vote for is Aaron Weiss sticking around as Don CIO for the next decade or more.
And you just said an important thing, by the way, because we have this tendency to rotate everybody every 3 or 4 years in our military paradigm. But the only reason Wayne Meyer and Rickover succeeded was time. They stayed in their position for over a decade in each case, 2 decades in Rickover's case. And Rod Remp was involved in that, getting it off the ground for about 6 years. So it takes time. It takes more time than a 3-year tour, that's for sure. I want to thank you, Dave. This has been a great discussion. We could probably go on for an hour or two, but I'm not sure anybody would watch it that long.
They can put it on 2.0 speed.
Yeah, right on. Did we solve any world hunger? I'm not sure. I think we admired a lot of problems. I'm not sure we solved any, but it was really, really a pleasure to dig into and improvise on a lot of stuff I wasn't prepared for. So thanks, Jim and Marv.
Well, defining the problem is the first step, right?
Yeah.
All right, I'll take this off record.
Thanks, everybody.